Don't underestimate the power of co-creation. I think we talked about it a lot today, about how we sit beside people, whether it's in assessment or it's in leadership, if you're a coach or you're someone who's looking at how do I change the system, but sitting beside with people and doing it with them is kind of the secret to all of it, I think.
Welcome to The Peg Doesn't Fit, the podcast that brings you the change makers in education. Tune in to hear from educational leaders who aren't content with the status quo educational model and are blazing their own path. Welcome, everybody. We've got Natalie Fartabasso.
Perfect.
She has come to us from old Canada. And we're about to hear some good stuff from her. So we'll start off with this question. It's basically a history lesson of your own career. How did you get to where you are? And maybe even tie in some of your philosophy of education. So all your educational roles, why are you such a change maker or wannabe? All that stuff.
Oh, man, that's a loaded opening question, but let's go. I'll go through the roles first and then hit you with why. So like most people, began as a teacher, so taught high school and middle school humanities for about 6 years. And then I eventually transitioned into an instructional coaching role. And then that shifted into an assessment leadership position in a K-12 context. And now I have made the daring leap into fully independent work in the education sphere. So I'm working as a speaker, a consultant, and an entrepreneur, which I always still bristle at saying, but I've launched my own program to support change agents in the education system to make real change happen in this complex system. And if we go all the way back to why change, I never wanted to be a teacher. I think that's a big caveat to just rip the Band-Aid on here. I was someone that once I had the keys to the kingdom, I felt like I was done with that. And I wanted to go live my bohemian creative life and never go back to the school system. But through a cosmic series of events, found myself back in education, but I made a promise to myself that I would only go back if I was going to change the system. And so I think my philosophy probably is really tied into that narrative itself. Because I borrowed this phrase, I can't own it. It comes from the brilliant Paulo Freire in his book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. I believe education must be a liberating praxis, which is a loaded word, but praxis just means knowledge into action. And so it's through our experiences and through our relationships, we gain knowledge of who we are. And then the action is how can we make an impact on the world as our authentic selves? And for me, that stayed consistent through all of my roles, everything I've done, because it's how I live my own life. I see education as a lifelong thing, not something that happens from the ages of 5 to 18 when we're in K-12 education, or I should say K-12 schooling.
Sure. Schooling. Oh, you've got that. Yeah. Don't let those two get confused, schooling and education or schooling and learning. Do you, within this consultancy, I'm curious, do you come in and then provide kind of a step-by-step to here's how you break the mold? And is it that district level? Is it admin level, teacher level? What does that
great,
look like?
Great question. So there's, because my mission has always been, you know, education's a liberating praxis, and there's a lot that we have to reimagine to get to that place. There's kind of two sides to the work that I do, and I see them as complementary. So when I made the decision to leave, I'd been recruited by a company in the States called Solution Tree, and they have an assessment center that operates within their wider PLC at work structure. So they have a pretty solid, like, step-by-step process of how they work with districts or individual schools, like charter schools, independent schools, to do the work of getting people organized around essential goals. We come in to help them figure out the evidence. So that's the one side of my work. However, I know as someone who made change on the inside as an instructional coach and then the assessment lead, that you need that catalyst in the system to really grow a network and like foster deep transformation. And I was worried that what I was doing on the other side with Solution Tree wasn't going to get there. So that led me down the entrepreneurialism path of, well, what if there was something for these people that are change agents on the inside, feeling isolated, alone? They need a community, they need support, they need mentorship that they're probably not getting from within the district and the traditional hierarchy, because people have their own interests and their own agendas. They need someone on the outside to really help them navigate this system and to recruit people into a coalition. So there's kind of two sides to what I do in consulting.
I'll tell you what, we are certainly blessed to have you, because our show is trying to attract those change agents, and here you are. So thank you for coming. We're so glad that you joined us. Well, let's fine tune in a little bit in terms of the instructional coaching, because we do want to talk about that. So I want you to put your hat back on when you were an instructional coach. And listen, I'm not saying that this is the case all the time, but there are some teachers who don't necessarily care for PD. And they certainly might not fully appreciate their coach. So as an instructional coach within a building, or even talking to teachers that might be listening to our show, how do we overcome that disconnect or that bitterness or that whatever feeling that is that just comes upon us when we walk into a professional development setting? How do we overcome that? I'll just leave it at that. I'm getting a little...
Oh, man. Well, I'm sure you both have things to add to this. I have so many thoughts. First thing I have to say directly from a person who used to be a coach to other coaches is I totally get the feeling of being the middle child of the education system. Like 100%. It's a role where you feel so misunderstood because you're not teacher enough for the teachers, but you're not leader enough for the leaders, but you're in the middle.
Like middle school.
It's like middle school. And also like middle school, I would argue, it is where we have the most capacity to do really innovative things and make change happen. Because everybody's kind of like, well, we don't really know what to do with you. So I have to say that right off the hop. But the biggest mistake that I see instructional coaches make, and I say this as someone who made this mistake, is running on this hamster wheel of trying to sell instructional strategies to the willing and finding their couple people. And if you keep on that hamster wheel, eventually you're going to feel like, okay, it's the same people coming to the pond every single time. I'm working with the same folks. These folks are over here going, whew, I'm just going to chill. I am in my country club of status quo, no stress, no pressure. For me, what changed everything was, and like we were talking right before we hit record, I had a moment of crisis where I was seeking validation from everybody, from the teachers, from the leaders, like, look at me, I know all this stuff. And, you know, I was pulled aside by a supervisor and told I was too passionate right before a PD day. And if I could tone it down, maybe people would like me more. And I remember just being shattered. Like, I was like, I have been killing myself to try to appear like valuable and knowledgeable and helpful. And it was in that moment that I had this epiphany that I've been looking down and I should have been looking up, and I had to set my sights on the system, specifically the assessment system. And that's a lofty enough goal that I couldn't achieve it all on my own. I had to work with other people. So it was this shift from like, I'm going to come do things for you, to I need you to help me.
Yeah.
And that shift seems so small, but it truly is huge as a coach. If you think of yourself more as like a facilitator of that community's learning and how you're going to pull people together under really important problems and goals, everything changes.
Yeah. So expand on that a little bit. I need help from you because it's bringing up a term that we've talked about a lot here. Ryan, you want to say it?
Collective efficacy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Look how we can read each other's minds, even across the divide.
Oh, I'm sure Natalie was thinking it as well. So how do you instill that in your staff?
I think I was already kind of alluding to it, but it, for me, collective efficacy begins and ends with a lofty goal that requires interdependence. I don't think when we put people into teams in schools, we give them the right things to work on.
Yeah.
I think they go into teams and they're planning fun days for the kids and dividing and conquering who's going to get the popcorn and, you know, slicing and dicing up easy divide and conquer tasks. But I mean, one thing I have to give to the DeFours and the PLC at Work process, that first fundamental idea of a professional learning community is a focus on learning and the belief that all students achieve high levels of learning, meeting grade level and beyond. If we accept that as the goal, like all means all, not like, oh, except for that class and except for this kid who's got some challenges and except for them over there, that's a challenging school. If we truly say our job is to work together to make sure that all learners achieve at high levels, then we have to lean on each other. I don't have all the skills to pull that off. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that's the parallel to my epiphany that, okay, I'm looking at this K-12 context. We have an absolute teacher lottery going on of like this teacher is just doing incredibly innovative work. Their kids are collaborating. They're solving complex problems. These kids are hardly in class and doing crossword puzzles, and that's what's populating the grade book. We need to get on the same page about what the actual learning goals are, K to 12, and get some kind of true vertical alignment happening here. That's a huge goal. There's like, even if I decided to completely close my door and go off and like power out a document for a year, I still could not achieve it. So I had to talk to other people and be like, do you see this too? And of course, everyone saw the problem of everyone's on different pages, they're in silos, they're not working as teams. So once you get them focused on the problem and say, let's build vertical alignment, then suddenly you've got a lot of buy-in just naturally.
My reflective thought for what you had just said actually was, sometimes I wonder, where do you start? And then I was also thinking, in the way you describe those teachers, which is kind of a universal thing, it's the same way as like when you think about students, we have to take what we're given. And in that same way, you almost have that with the teaching cohort that belongs, that arrives in your building, because even despite some best hiring practices, the university system that cranks out teachers also provides varying levels of efficacy of teachers, that to where some might just have, some kids skirted through the system, gave a great interview, and they are the crossword class teacher, or please copy my PowerPoint that I'm giving to you. And so there, I wonder sometimes when I think, do you start to solve the problem at the university level? I don't know, because I think what you're saying is, let's just start here. What are we given? Let's work on vertical alignment. Because those outside forces, if you try to tackle too many of them, it's too much.
But sometimes that vertical alignment, I mean, that's still like, that's almost even a district initiative, right? I mean, like if everybody's not on page within the district to get those vertical between the elementary, the middle, and the high schools, then, you know, one school going at it and saying, well, let's really go for the, you know, and try to get a feeder pattern maybe. I mean, at least that's how it works in the States, right? You got a variety of elementary schools that feed into one middle school or two middle schools, and then they feed into one or two high, you know, usually one high school. And maybe that area is vertically aligned, but then what about the rest of your district? So for people that are listening to us in a big districts, I mean, that's a huge undertaking to talk about vertical alignment. So to keep it kind of focused within the school, I mean, the one thing that when we, you know, when we went into this collective efficacy, you're talking about, you got those really super innovative teachers, and then you've got your crossword puzzle teachers. Have you had an opportunity to witness, say, providing that innovative teacher with some PD time to try to talk to those other teachers? Because maybe, and no offense to instructional coaches listening out here, but sometimes teachers don't really want to listen to us, but they'll listen to their peers, you know, that are in the trenches with them. So do you have experience allowing teachers, you know, giving them a step for the day, and you lead the PD and finding success in that realm?
Yes, absolutely. Something that I actually talk about a lot in the program is how important story is, to catalyze change in a complex system, because we've moved out of the era where there was complicated systems where you could have one boss and the boss could organize the pieces and everything was kind of lockstep. Now we're so interconnected because of technology that things are like a web. And so story is so powerful because it activates the head, heart, and hands and gets people moving. So when I got about 2 years into my assessment leadership role, I always tell people I shifted from being the assessment specialist to a marketing and communication specialist. And I very, very rarely was in front of the group. I was actively trying to figure out, what are the stories of things that are happening? Aha moments people are having, epiphanies, epic fails. Like, how do we amplify that too? They tried something and it didn't work, but here's this crazy insight they have now. And I would try to fill PD days with their stories. And for me, that was when I felt like a true coach, like not someone who was coming in with an instructional strategy I'd mastered and I'm giving it to everyone, like everyone look at mentor texts or building thinking classrooms, because that's what I see a lot of people do. They master their one thing and then they just go model it for a million people. But I would actually be coaching them to say, what you've done here is important. Like what you've discovered and what you've unleashed with student learning is such a valuable story. Let's talk about why, like, and I was podcasting. I was about 2.5 years into podcasting. So all of this was very interconnected for me. I'd gotten a lot better at asking questions and crafting a narrative. So I'd get them up in front of people all the time and have to coach them the night before when they're like, I can't do it. I'm embarrassed. Like, I don't want to look like I'm bragging, or I don't want to look like I'm not good at my job because it didn't work out perfectly. And I'd actually be coaching them as a human being about finding their voice and trusting that what they have to say is valuable, even if, you know, they're not someone who's published a book or, you know, has a huge Twitter following.
Right.
And I think that's so, so important in these roles. Again, it's that shift, it's shifting away from like, look at me, I'm valuable, to being like, how do I amplify other people? How do I get this system moving and growing and learning? And I think that's through amplifying stories.
Thank you for sharing.
You got me frantically typing notes and writing things down. Like, I might want to implement that even on my, I have an upcoming PD day Monday. And I'm just thinking about, I've tried to normalize failure with some stories.
Yeah.
Which is I've really enjoyed, and I think they have too, but also just like sharing what they're doing in their class.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll give you two really, really specific ones, because I feel like if you're writing notes, I got two awesome ideas.
Well, Bartle's a note taker.
I would find a couple people. This is such an easy low-hanging fruit one to say, like, what were your aha moments from the past week? And if I had a few people planted and I'd get them to start the day or the meeting or whatever. And then more people would naturally, like, that's what story does. Like, and we'll get into this maybe when we talk about the theme of my podcast this season, but it activates neural mirroring. So when I hear you tell that story, it's going to make me feel empathy, and it's going to bring up all the same for me. So two people share their aha moments. Suddenly everyone's hopping on the mic. We were doing a lot of things online. It was during COVID wanted to share their stories. And so that's one example. And then a more complex one that's not actually that hard to plan is when we were talking about a new initiative or a new strategy, instead of like the usual, I'm going to get up there and do my 30-minute perfectly canned spiel that, you know, is communications approved. I'm instead going to do, so we did a panel, and ironically, the same supervisor who told me I was too passionate called this a spectacle, which tells you I was probably on the right path. But we had four members of staff come up, very differing levels of experience, subject area. And I just interviewed them like as if it was a podcast, and we did it live and we did a connect, extend, challenge thinking routine. So how does this connect to your current practice? How is it going to extend your current practice? And where are you finding some big challenges here? And these were people that were really respected and not the types that would often get up and want to have the stage, so to speak. So them sharing, like, I'm really struggling with this. Like, I'm having such a hard time. I'm drowning. Like, that level of vulnerability is just like, you can hear a pin drop when you do that live in front of people.
No, that sounds powerful. And other things that I've been doing just on a simple level, because I do all the assessments and the data at my school, and I'll see teachers have data walls in their classroom, right? I'll just take a picture and send it to everybody. I'll be like, check this out. Kudos to this teacher for doing that. And it just plants a seed, because when you're a teacher, sometimes you just get stuck in that little silo of your room and you don't really know what's going on out there. So it's not that teacher is so much better than somebody else. They thought of an idea, they did it, and let's share it with everybody else. So it's not just this isolated story within a classroom of how someone's successfully using data to drive motivation and instruction. And then surely enough, you know, you walk around and then another one pops up and another one pops up. And I think coming in and having a panel and having an actual discussion with those teachers about how their students value that would be a benefit to the rest of the staff. So great idea.
Yeah. How they build off each other is so fascinating too. It just starts to happen naturally in the little humorous moments and, you know, and throw someone in there that maybe is your quote unquote resistor. Like, sure. I truly believe that we quickly see people that are not jumping in and are being an early adopter is like a problem. And like, how are we going to manage them? Those were always the people who became my biggest champions in this work. If we shift it to like, I need your help. Can you give me feedback on this? We're looking at this. Could you come be a part of this panel? I think your perspective is really important. Suddenly that person's like, oh, okay. But it's different than telling them, I want you to do it this way.
Right.
But once they're in and they feel valued, like, I had my favorite story is the high school math teacher. And he's like such an archetype in some levels. He'd been there for like 30 years. You know, he was friends with everyone. He was the sports guy, and he just kept it simple in the classroom, you know, just didn't like all to get all into all the new fancy innovative ideas. But I really brought him in because like he had a lot of social capital and sway, mm-hmm. and he didn't want to buy into the stuff. He didn't want to work with a coach, but invited him to the panel and then invited him to our assessment committee / coalition, I like to call it. And would always thank him when he presented a dissenting idea in a meeting. I'd send a message after to say, you know what, we really need this because we're getting a little bit of like, we can sometimes be a bit of an echo chamber in here.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly but surely, he just needed time to process it through his own lens. And then he's the one presenting at the board meetings using sports analogies to explain why we have to radically transform our grading system. Like you truly never know, but you just have to start from how do you bring them in and amplify and co-create.
That's a great strategy. Sometimes, you know, the biggest defectors, they're not necessarily bad teachers. They have good ideas that are just different from everybody else's. And if you give them a platform to listen to their ideas, well, then that could just become part of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Awesome.
And these wicked problems, they need a lot of different solutions. Like, mm-hmm. there is a misconception, I think, and Eric, as someone who's in the assessment work, you probably bump up against this, that when we talk about like having essential standards or having shared goals or standards in general, that it's about standardization. Like people often mix those two things up. Mm-hmm. And you can have shared goals on a team that you all decide are the most important and all of your students are going to get there. But how you each get them there, that's the creativity and the brilliance of each teacher. Right. So I've had to go into some coaching situations where they're like, we need them all doing the exact same lessons and the exact same assessment in the exact same way. Can you get them on the same page? And had to like check them and be like, that's not the goal. You're mm-hmm. actually missing the point altogether because your collective efficacy is going to be zero if you don't let people show up as their individual selves and then show the team what they did and perhaps learn from one another, because that's mm-hmm. how the group actually achieves that big goal, not all doing it the same way that one person probably dominated.
Although I will dissent just mildly, though, yes, the way we get there is completely autonomous. However, there is value in having common assessments.
Absolutely. Common formative assessments.
Well, like, but common assessments, even, I think, I'm just thinking of sports analogies myself. Like, let's just say football, because it's on some people's mm-hmm. minds. The grading is more like, are you a good passer? Are you a good catcher? Are you a good runner? Mm-hmm. Your common assessment is more akin to who won the most games or who did the thing most successfully. But even that can be measured differently, I think. Like, and even mm-hmm. common assessments, though handy, not have to be that standardized either, I guess.
Yeah, there's the element of, I think, standard criteria, like at this mm-hmm. level of the proficiencies or a learning progression, we are all going to gather evidence and we're going to collectively share that evidence with one another. That's our commitment to each other. However, we have such a diversity of students that to say, well, they all have to do it written, otherwise it's not a good assessment, is not okay. matching the diversity of the students. So we could say it's a constructed response, which ups the level of cognitive rigor, but some students might do it orally, some might do it written. And I think that's where there's some nuance here that absolutely there should be common expectations of cognitive rigor that's being expected and that we're holding each other accountable to and on the same page for, but the formats for those assessments can mm-hmm. change because our students are diverse.
Sure. Well, let's talk about this because we've kind of been talking about learning targets.
Number five.
I want your opinion on this. So every lesson should have a target, correct? I mean, every lesson we should have a goal of what we want to accomplish, right? We call that a learning target, correct? Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. What's your position on if those need to be posted for the student or do they just need to be told to the student?
Like verbally or written?
Yeah. You know how like sometimes an administrator might want your target written on the board. So when they walk into classroom, they know what your target is. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So,
well, my understanding of learning targets, so I'm going to take it back one step, is they are something that we arrive at when we take a standard and we unpack it into a learning progression and sequence it from simple to the full complex demonstration of that. Right. So I want to first clarify that if teachers are looking at targets as like an eye roll thing I have to do for my admin, and I'm just going to write some random goal on the board every day, then I don't know if I can swear on this podcast, but I don't give a shit.
Like, yes!
You know,
hey, no, that's I'm like, not what I'm, that's not
no,
what
no,
I'm
no.
Talking
but
about.
If it's like a, if it's a target because you are as a team aiming for essential standards and you've unpacked it and you're clear about those formative targets on the pathway to summative proficiency, like for sure, make this, and it shouldn't be the one target though. I believe in giving the kids the entire progression. They should know at any point in time, like, yeah, today we're working on this target, but I know the essential standard. I know the progression of targets that I need to achieve to get there. And I know exactly where I am on that pathway at any given time, because we can't invest in learning that we can't see.
So what are some good ways you've done that or seen that done for students?
I mean, I've seen teachers, actually someone down in Kansas who is an English teacher. He had a really awesome booklet he made for students at the beginning of, he actually, for their whole course, he called it his feedback tracker booklet. So they had their four, I can send it to you after it's, he gave it to me to share because it's awesome. He had their 4 to 5 essential standards for ELA, for English Language Arts. And then in there, they had unpacked the targets for each of those standards and the students could see it. And they'd actually built in a page where they said, you know, at different points throughout the year, we're going to be asking you to go in and recording what pieces of evidence you have that you want to make sure are counted towards this standard. And here's the targets. And I think they use the language of criteria. People always are a little, the semantics of this can get tricky, right? Is it a target or intention?
Right.
But I thought that was really brilliant. And then lots of other ways they could track their feedback throughout. I think leveraging technology is just such a no-brainer. Like most of these platforms are offering artifacting and portfolio platforms for free. One that I love right now is called Got Learning, started by a guy named Mike Rutherford, really fascinating background, total change maker in education, but he came from outside of education into education. So we aligned on that front, but it allows you to, you can organize it by anything you want. You could organize it by essential standards, or you could organize it if there's a dominant task type the kids are going to be doing repeatedly, like essays. But then they get to put all their evidence of learning and all the feedback is tracked there. So you get to see the loop and they can actually scroll through it. And so it allows them and the admin and the parents to go through and to see the growth over time, which I think is so, so important. But I think anything we can do to make the learning so clear and transparent, the goals so transparent, the better. Like you're going to see more investment. That's the heart of investment, is our clarity. With,
and I guess that's my thought. You know, whenever I think of posting learning targets, I don't think of just checking off a box and posting up at the front of the room and saying at the beginning of the lesson, this is what we're going to do today. I mean, what I envision is having the learning target posted, telling the class at the beginning of class, this is what we're going to learn today. Throughout the lesson, as questions come up, you can refer back to it and say, no, listen, let me get you refocused. I love your idea, but look at this. This is what we're trying to get that to fit into. This is what we're learning. And then at the end of the class period, have a quick assessment, whether it be an exit ticket or whatever, to determine if what you sought out to do actually happened. And if it didn't, then reflect and look at the next day of trying to figure out how can I spiral that back in with what I'm already planning on doing to make sure that my kids learned it. And that's what I think maybe sometimes teachers, they don't recognize the practicality of that.
The ultimate question I always ask to help people arrive at that, because I bumped up against that a million times, because teachers view that kind of work as, what, do you think I don't know what I'm doing? You think I don't know what I'm teaching? Like that would be the pushback I would often get. And I would say,
what it is.
Do the students know though?
Right.
So I'm like, the ultimate goal of assessment is to create the conditions for learners to be assessors on their own behalf.
Yes.
Like that is what we're doing with setting up all this infrastructure. It's not so that we can continue to hold assessment dear. We really want them to have agency and to be driving that full self-regulated learning process through assessment. I feel like I'm preaching to the choir. We're all like, yeah.
Well, you are, but hopefully everybody else is either part of the choir or this can help them be better missionaries.
And what you're saying, preaching to the choir. Now, here's the deal. This happens to me in education all the time, right? So I might have read a book or learned something in PD like first quarter, because that's sometimes the downfall of PD, is that you're the sage on the stage and you give your masterful strategy that you've mastered, and you might give that on August 15th. And then on November 12th, you're doing a walkthrough and you're like, why aren't you using that strategy? We covered it back in August. You know what I'm saying? Because sometimes mm-hmm. we hit it and then we move and then we never talk about it ever again. Mm-hmm. Right. So sometimes, you know, when you're doing this preaching to the choir, we've all heard it. But sometimes just hearing it again from a different person at the right time when our mind is ready to absorb better than it was the time that the PD was given. And all of a sudden it clicks and it's like, oh, my God, why haven't I been doing it? You know what I mean?
Yep. Now that I've become an entrepreneur, it's like everything's about repetition. That's been the hardest like mindset shift to make, is that I kind of have my core message. Yeah. And every day that I tweet it or I put it on Instagram, 10 new people see it for the first time, you know? So, and also for people, like you said, that have seen it, they say it takes 7 times for a message to like sink in. So it's actually an act of generosity to be repetitive.
Yeah.
Very good. I'm writing more notes about, I'm thinking I might do a PD theme for the year next year.
Oh yeah. What theme?
Yeah. I don't know, but I'm just thinking I need to maybe pick one, because I remember when I worked in the district, we only have 8 PD days for the whole year. That's all we have available to us in my district. And when I worked in the same district as Eric, we had several PD days throughout the year, plus PD twice a week during, as one of your class periods, the teachers go to class. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of PD, but he spoke directly to what I felt as a teacher, because I was a teacher at his building. I was like, the joke was, what's PD going to be about today? Because it felt like you had no idea and it was going to be some random thing, or it didn't connect with the time before. And I think that is so powerful. Like, give it at least, I mean, if I have 8 things, maybe I do it 7 times. That's part of that message.
Yeah.
I really want to talk to you about a tweet you put on from somebody else, but I'll hold on to it, because it doesn't tie in with our theme of this yet. I'll save it.
Okay.
There's no better time than now, Ryan. We can't
talk to Miss teased us.
Try to basso for the rest of the night. We got to wrap this up at some point.
Okay, because their next one was a different quote related to our theme. I'll transfer it though, because it's really totally different, I think. But it was something, I think it was either your tweet or you posted it as somebody else's tweet. But it was like, if schools are run as a business, we'd be going bankrupt. And it reminded me, I'm not sure what your meaning was specifically of that, but I also read a fascinating article that I still cannot relocate, but it was essentially, what if we ran grocery stores like schools? And how horrible would that be? Like, you're stuck with the grocery store that's in your neighborhood. You don't get to choose what's on the shelf. They'll give you whatever it is that's available at the moment. And it reminded me of that same kind of illusion being the ALL illusion, from education to the business world, and how we seem to think like, well, we would never do that with a grocery store, but in education, we're just like, well, of course that is the best.
Yep.
So I wanted to go back to your business thing. What prompted you to call that out?
I didn't say it, first of all. I agree. It's Peter Hausstrasser, who hosts a podcast called Disrupt Education. I feel like y'all would get along very well. But he teaches high school business. So I think that's where that line came from when he said it on the podcast. And then I took that clip and tweeted it out. But I think, especially being in entrepreneurship now, it's been a fascinating 6 months for me, because in education, we really like villainize and kind of look at business and industry as like, ew, capitalism, that's bad. But being out here, you realize that like, money is all an exchange of value.
Right.
And you need to be always providing value for your user or your customer.
Mm-hmm.
So if back to the point, if education were a business and our value was based on the impact we're having on learners, we might go bankrupt.
Yeah.
Natalie, I think we are going bankrupt. I mean, we're all broke. Yeah. Districts or states are cutting money left and right. Districts are, it seems like the more we spend, the less, the worse our results are. You know what I'm saying? I don't know what the answer is, but we definitely are in need of a change.
my hope, my the whole empowerment ecosystem dream with what I've created is like, and who knows, maybe I'll burn out and change my mind in 5 years, check back in with me. But I really believe if that's like, hence the name, if we can connect the people on the inside that need to be uplifted and amplified and help mm-hmm. them to have the tools to do the same and build networks mm-hmm. Of people that are connected and have a dream of a different type of education in the school system, then I think we can do it. Like, I really think there is magic in the critical mass. I think there is truth in the tipping point. But I think the design of schools has made it so we're so siloed and disconnected, and there's competition and it's still a hierarchy and people are worried about climbing the ladder and job prospects. And mm-hmm. there's all this other stuff that I'm hoping if we play this inside outside game where folks like me and others that have left and are kind of outside of the system don't have to worry about impacts on my job. Like, I can just radically support the people. Mm-hmm. Hopefully. I think us human beings are very creative, innovative folks, especially teachers and especially those middle children, instructional coaches and mm-hmm. consultants. And so I'm hopeful still.
Do you think that can happen within the public school setting, or are we going to need charter schools to jumpstart what public education is? You know what I'm saying? I mean, because it's just
okay. You want some real talk?
Listen, that might be
No. I'm going to get real personal and honest.
I think we need to go that route.
Okay. Man, so, well, my background is a private school. Like, I worked in a special education private school, and I went in with the mindset that this is going to be the juggernaut of change. It's going to be the speedboat. It is on its own. It's just us. We have to remember that a lot of the parents that pull their kids out of the traditional school system have a lot of money and means, and they want school to look very similar to what they experienced. And they have a lot of influence on those communities. I have seen some of the most traditional crap in so many independent and private schools, with all of this beautiful verbiage on the website about personalize this and individualize that, and we're building change makers, and they're like, the parents are demanding, you know, evidence that their kids are learning, so they do all these like low level rote tasks, get lots of data. Like, I don't know if that's the answer because of the money piece, and perhaps charters will, but like, okay, let's take the example of High Tech High. It is like the mecca of innovative schooling in America. It's down in San Diego. They've been out there for like a hot second doing extremely innovative things with incredible outcomes. Has that been the beacon of possibility that's tipped the public education system? No. And it's exactly the same problem as when teachers that become instructional coaches say, here's a strategy. It worked for me. I want it to work for you. Everyone goes, not in my classroom. I was tweeting about this today, and I don't think a lot of people understood what I was trying to say, but I'm like, we're still thinking in silos.
Yeah.
Well, if they do it over there, then maybe it'll prove that it works, but people are still in their little silo, not thinking, not rethinking, not trying anything different.
I think if you put the mass of all education workers, teachers, admin, whatever, into that spectrum of early adoption versus whatever, I think we are still way at the front end of early adoption. Like, I don't think we've seen enough High Tech High or Acton Academy or whatever it is out there to really convince somebody that grew up in a traditional setting that there was anything wrong with it. Like, I heard somebody say it's almost like a religion. Like, you feel like you're giving up something about your core to admit that maybe, like, I'm not even saying I had a great public education experience, but that doesn't mean it could not have been way better had I been in a different, very non-traditional setting. Yeah. Like, I can't imagine. Like, I feel like it's almost educational malpractice what we're doing, but we don't have enough examples of what is different to maybe go, oh my gosh, wow, yet. But they're out there. Sudbury model, all that, that stuff. I also wonder about private education. Like, you're right that a lot of established private places are just traditional institutions, but I often think that private from scratch could help, you know, like, I don't know, somebody starting a micro school that looks different or whatever, but Because then if you bring the money to those schools, like one of our guests in the past, Matt Bodrov, that did do an Acton Academy in Sacramento, like he started a private school that looks very different, that has a lot of money going into it.
Mm-hmm.
But those are few and far between right now.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, just it all makes my head hurt because I know how bad we need it, but yeah. I also know how ingrained our society is. And it makes me wonder, we had Ross Parker on not too long ago talking about, you know, just kind of the evolution of technology and kind of how it's come. And we're not done seeing a ridiculous amount of growth. I mean, what's that new AGT chat? I mean,
Chat GPT.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I need to learn a little more about that because I'm kind of against it. But at the same time, I think it's gonna change the world. Mm-hmm. And education is just fighting it. Oh no, we can't have a system where kids can just type in a few keywords and get a paper. Well, why not? That's what they're going to be doing at the business world.
If your assignment is that crappy that it can be generated by computer, you have to wonder if it should be done in the first place.
It's like a call to action for performance assessments. But all this talk has me thinking about Peter Senge. He says, you know, systems don't change, people do. Mm-hmm. And so I have gone through periods, some dark periods of very nihilistic, like there's nothing that's going to change. It's ingrained. And here's the epiphany that I've had that maybe be helpful for anyone listening right now, is that all we can change is ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So there is so much unlearning and untangling of the system that we all were conditioned by. So how can we think less in silos? How can we lean into our emotions and accept them as feedback? How can we be more vulnerable? How can we embrace rest as an act of rebellion? Like there's such a grind culture in wider culture, but definitely in schools too, right? Like productivity, go, go, go. Like teachers bragging about being up all night, planning. And it's like, I think the only thing, what I'm coming to realize that we can do to really disrupt all of that is to be a beacon of possibility of like, this is what it feels like to live in something that isn't this. And unless we get to that space ourselves, I don't think we are ever going to be able to get there, because it all starts here. Everything we want to experience out there always starts here.
Right.
So I can't chase happiness. I have to cultivate happiness now. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's kind of that principle. And my fear with everything starting up, and it actually came from a story someone told me who's intimately involved with High Tech Highs, there's been a lot of regression to status quo over the past few years. And I don't want to name the person just in case, because I don't have their, but what's really interesting is they cited research that that's the case again and again and again. You get this really innovative new thing and everybody looks at it as the thing, mm-hmm. but then it reverts. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about that and was writing about it for things for the podcast. I think we're not doing enough of like the personal transformation in a lot of this. I think we're still living in the single loop learning of like, what's the thing? What's the next thing? What's the next thing? And not going all the way back to like just untangling, who am I? Like, what do I value? How does that intersect with the system currently? Like, what are my paradigms? And I don't think we are comfortable yet hosting PD or school spaces where people can like really get raw. Like I'm talking a day where people cry and deal with like their institutional debt that they've been holding on to for years, whether in their school or their system, or I don't think we break through until we get comfortable going to those kinds of places.
Well, and that's, again, preaching to the choir, but they've always said, I mean, you have to establish trust. There's mm-hmm. no way that you're going to get a group of teachers to express that kind of vulnerability unless they feel comfortable knowing that when they do express that kind of vulnerability, they're not going to get judged by their peers.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be that element of trust there where it's okay. This is a safe spot. It's okay to do that. But I think everything you just talked mm-hmm. about is a great segue, because we do have to wrap this up. So it's a great segue into your own podcast.
Hey,
Crush. And you alluded to that a little bit earlier about how your season theme is storytelling, but do you have anything that you want to throw now? Now, listen, Peg doesn't fit listeners. We're not encouraging you by any stretch of the imagination to leave our podcast and go to her. But
that's scarcity mindset, Eric. There's plenty of us.
Abundance.
There's plenty of
us. Certainly add a second podcast to listen to.
It's a yes and both
that's
and.
That's right.
Yeah, EduCrush. So this season's essential question, if you will, is how might we rehumanize education through story? I'll tell you the secret behind that. I'm writing a book right now and the manuscript's due in June, and that's the topic. So I thought this would be a sneaky way to like integrate all of my work. So as I wrote for the podcast, I could use it for the book. It has not worked out. I get way too inspired by whatever guest has come on, and then it takes me in a new direction every week. So anywho, but it's, so unpack it a little bit, because that's like, those are two huge, like rehumanize. What does that even mean? I remember the first time I said it and everyone's like, yeah. And then one of my, you know, critical friends was like, but what are you, what does that mean? Everyone can agree it sounds nice. So I really sat with that. And that was the first chapter of the book I wrote. Like, I was like, let's tease apart this idea of humanity. If we're going to say rehumanize, it means going back to this honoring of our humanity. And then what does story have to do with that? And so here's what I've arrived at. So I think our humanity could be divided into kind of three subsections: our consciousness, our empathy, and our culture. So if the science fiction movies have anything to say about humans, it's that our consciousness is what defines us from machines, right? Mm-hmm. And our consciousness is just that thing that's going through life, collecting all of this like stimulus and then organizing it into a cause and effect. It's like, oh, that happened because X, Y, and Z. Like our brain's just a storyteller. It's trying to make sense of things all the time through story, like antecedent and consequence. And so if that's true for each of us, then when someone else tells a story, because our brains are wired that way, we naturally connect. And that's our empathy. We feel it. Like there's actual like physiological evidence of this thing called neuromirroring. Like I mentioned earlier, it's like when you're watching an action movie and somebody's on the edge of the building and you feel like you're about to jump off the edge of a building all of a sudden, it's like our bodies just physiologically go there. So there's those two facets. And then there's culture, and shout out to Yuval Noah Harari, who wrote Sapiens and 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. Brilliant, blew my mind. Mm. But culture is just shared fictions. Like, what is our North American culture if not, you know, shared understandings of what democracy means and shared understandings and stories of what money means? Like, really, the pieces of paper we hand to one another mean nothing. There's just a story around it. Mm. And so if you take all of that stuff, like that's really what we want to cultivate in school, right? Like we want culture, we want consciousness, we want people that are mentally making meaning all the time. We want people that are empathizing with one another. Then it goes without saying that story has to be at the center of what we do if we want those outcomes. So that was kind of a long-winded way to unpack what the theme is, but we're tackling it from a literal perspective of like, what are the stories that we need to amplify that are often marginalized and are not taken into account when we designed schools? And also, what is kind of the more metacognitive level of stories? So what are the stories that we tell ourselves about who we are based on the way the school system is designed? So I did one episode about my experiences with assessment as a student and how that taught me this habit for perfectionism that I'm still trying to unlearn. And so how can we build different systems that help people to tell different stories about who they are?
That
was a lot.
No, it sounds fascinating. It really does. And
so
and
does that guide who your guests are as well?
Yeah. Yeah. For the most part. So like Shane Safir, someone I had down, is like my unicorn guest. She wrote a book called Street Data. I don't know if either of you have read it. It's brilliant. Eric is someone who works in like the data space. She talks about how we have to balance quantitative data with like the stories, the qualitative, that human evidence that often gets relegated as an extra rather than a equal.
Yeah.
So that was a really great episode. And then also a guest that's, I love getting guests outside of education. I don't know if that lands with my audience all the time, but I feel like education isn't just schools. Like, and you both get it. When we talk about education, it's like society, it's culture, it's our lives. Mm-hmm. So I love to get guests that'll just challenge our thinking. Like this one who talked about, she had written a whole book and done research into myths. And if we reimagine myths from the perspective of the woman, because most of them are written by men, how does that help women to understand like how they can step into their own inherent power in society today? You know, So it's like Eve wasn't bad because she took the apple. It's like, she is someone who's curious and driven and wants to seek knowledge. So how can we lean into that as a strength? Things like that. So just repurposing story.
Well, both Ryan and I are language arts teachers.
You're right, like, yes, up our alley. Let's go. I know, me too. That was my background. It's probably obvious at this point.
Well, listen, Natalie, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on our show. you know, we'll let you wrap it up. Is there anything maybe that we didn't talk about that you want to make sure that before we leave, that you just drive this point into our listeners on our way out of here?
Don't underestimate the power of co-creation. I think we talked about it a lot today, about how we sit beside people, whether it's in assessment or it's in leadership, if you're a coach or you're someone who's looking at how do I change the system, but sitting beside with people and doing it with them is kind of the secret to all of it, I think. And I have to end on a plug. If you are one of those middle children, a coach, a consultant, an assessment lead, whatever the title may be, who's feeling misunderstood and isolated amongst the status quo, and you want to find your people and your voice to make real change, then look me up. I'm on Twitter at Natabasso, and shoot me a DM, because we'd love to have you in the empowerment ecosystem. It's for those radical change makers who need a community.
That is fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Natalie. We certainly appreciate your time, and wish you the best of luck in the rest of your career.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure. I'd love to return the favor at some point, have you all on
EduFresh. That'd be great.
Awesome.
Story.
As always, thank you for checking us out at The Peg Doesn't Fit. We appreciate you listening. You can find us on Twitter at The Peg Doesn't Fit. You can find me at Ryan D. Bartle 1.
And my personal Twitter is at Eric J. Steven. You can also email us at thepegdoesntfit@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at anchor.fm/thepegdoesntfit.
Drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Tell your educator friends or family, anybody. We'd love to hear from you.
All right. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week on The Peg Doesn't Fit.